is Our American Stories, and we love to talk about everything that matters in life, and that is love and death, music, the arts, history, business, you name it, and of course, sports. But music, probably more than anything else, we spend the most time on. And today we've got a heck of a story about an artist. We've spent some time on this artist, and that's Kurt Cobain, his tragic life, his immense talent, his suicide. It's so sad. And yet what he left us, the music he left us, I think is still influencing songwriters around the world. And on this day in history, one of the greatest videos ever in MTV, and many people think that this is a reason why MTV was MTV, there was a day there were music videos on that channel. And, well, Jesse Edwards, as always, does a great job for us here on this report.
This day in music history, Nirvana shot the music video for Smells Like Teen Spirit at GMT Studios in Culver City, California, costing less than $50,000 to make. The shoot features real Nirvana fans as the audience. The song did not initially chart, and it only sold well in regions of the United States with an established fan base for the group. Smells Like Teen Spirit was not expected to be a hit because it was merely intended to be the base-building alternative rock cut for the album. It was anticipated that the follow-up single Come As You Are would be the song that could cross over to mainstream formats. Kurt Cobain said that Smells Like Teen Spirit, the opening track and lead single from the group's second album, Nevermind, was an attempt to write a song in the style of the Pixies, a band he greatly admired. Cobain didn't even begin to write Smells Like Teen Spirit until a few weeks before recording started on that second album in 1991. He came up with the song's title when his friend Kathleen spray-painted Kurt Smells Like Teen Spirit on his wall. Since they'd been discussing anarchism, punk rock, and similar topics, Cobain interpreted the slogan as having a revolutionary meaning. What his friend actually meant, however, was that Cobain smelled like the deodorant Teen Spirit, which his girlfriend wore. Cobain later claimed that he was unaware that it was a brand of deodorant until months after the single was released. Sales skyrocketed for the deodorant brand soon after. The song was released on September 10th as the lead single from Nevermind, the band's major label debut on DGC Records. The unexpected success of Smells Like Teen Spirit in late 1991 propelled Nevermind to the top of the charts at the start of 1992. The song was Nirvana's first and biggest hit, reaching number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100 and charting all over the planet in 91 and 92. The video, which was based on the concept of a school concert which ends in a riot, won the group 2 MTV Video Music Awards. In 2000, the Guinness World Records named Teen Spirit the most played video on MTV Europe. Nirvana eventually grew uncomfortable with the success and attention Spirit received as a result. In the years since Kurt Cobain's death, listeners and critics have continued to praise Smells Like Teen Spirit as one of the greatest rock songs of all time. In the year 2000, MTV and Rolling Stone ranked the song third on their joint list of the 100 best pop songs, trailing only the Beatles' Yesterday and the Rolling Stones' I Can't Get No Satisfaction. This day in music history.
And as so often the case, mere accidents happen. By the way, the artists never predict what's going to happen in these matters. Geffen Records had no plans for this record. And as one marketing executive said, as the albums just flew out the door, duck, just duck. And it just became a smash for Geffen and that label. And now we segue over to Steve Goldberg. And he's just one of our favorite commentators in this country. No one's ever heard of him except, well, the thousands of people who studied at him at City College when he was a sociology professor. And he's been sharing some daydreams with us. And, well, here's Steven Goldberg's second daydream.
A baby is somehow crawled to the outer ledge of a third floor window. The crowd below beseeches the baby to stop short of the edge, but to no avail.
Hasta la vista, baby.
The baby puts one hand over the edge and then falls to his seeming doom. I break into a dash, running as fast as I can. I leap the final 2 feet to where I figure the baby will land. Catch the baby and come down on my back. I'm somewhat bruised, but the baby is safe. A reporter asked, what did it feel like when you caught the baby? Well, when I was a little kid, I, like a billion other little kids, dreamed of being the guy who finally filled that left field position my Brooklyn Dodgers could never fill successfully. We had never won a World Series, losing to the Yankees year after year, and it was World Series time once again.
The final game of the 1952 World Series.
It's the bottom of the ninth and the seventh game of the series. We're winning 1-0, and the Yankees are up with two outs and the runner on first.
Well, let's see what Mantle can do now.
Mickey Mantle is at bat. If he hits a homer, the Yankees win and we're losers still once again. If we somehow manage to get Mantle out, Mantle, who seems to hit a home run every time he comes to bat, then we win. But no one's betting on this. The pitch comes in.
That one's going high and deep into right field.
Mantle hits this tremendous shot just inside the right field line. I break into a dash, running as fast as I can, past Snyder in center, past Ferrillo in right, to just inside the right field line.
At the wall, he leaps!
Crash into the wall and make this stupendous leaping catch.
Spectacular catch! Crashing into the wall!
And finally, we are the world champions.
And
that's
there we...
what it felt like.
And there we have it, Stephen Goldberg. And by the way, as he always tells us, these daydreams are all arrived in his brain, fully formed. And he also said they're completely unexpected. And as he always tells us, that's the wonderful thing about daydreams. They require absolutely no talent. This is Lee Habib, and we love bringing you Steve Goldberg, that professor you wish you had for almost anything, but that you didn't have. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
Sometime to write a little song so you don't forget it. Sometime to write a little song to remember.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Marty Scorsese and Robert De Niro, twice this song appears in work they did together, and that's why we bumped into it. And today on this day in history, in 1943, Robert De Niro was born, and we're going to spend a bit of time talking about his life, or actually getting other people to talk about his life, because like so many actors, he was and is still a very shy guy, and that seems so counterintuitive. But indeed, it is the truth about so many people who call themselves and are artists. The one time that De Niro actually articulated the craft of acting and what it entailed came in this interview you're about to hear. It lasts a very long, for Robert De Niro, 1 minute.
Yeah, you just, and it's simpler than you think, and you don't, and it's very hard for actors, and I get caught up in that myself, where you have to do more, do something, and you don't have to do anything, nothing, and you're better off, and it'll work the way people are in life. They don't do anything. They could, you know, I'm talking to you, and I'm looking at your expression, and you could have been told that somebody in your family was this or that, some terrible thing. You're still going to have the same look on your face, and that says more, allows the audience to read into it as opposed to you telling them what they should feel. And actors tend at times to try and so they have to give it something, and they don't have to give it anything. So with David, if we're just working and working and doing all these things, you don't have time to think about, well, this or that, or how do I spin it or interpret it. You just have to do it, and it'll take care of itself.
And if you remember, and by the way, you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to the hour we did on Al Pacino. He talked over and over again about a prayer he invoked whenever he was getting in the way of himself. And it, of course, was from The Agony and the Ecstasy. And that, of course, is the story of the great painter who painted the Sistine Chapel and had blocks. And his prayer always was, Lord, free me from myself so I can serve you. And he was always talking about how he was getting in the way of his own best performances. We just heard the same from Robert De Niro. But now let's talk about other folks who, well, they were happy to talk about Robert De Niro. And at the AFI Lifetime Achievement Awards, a pretty good actress named Meryl Streep, she kicked things off.
What is it that makes us love certain actors? What is it in their voice, their looks, their smile, a glance that just captures us for life? Actors love Bob's work because it's unfailingly honest and it's uncluttered. He's relentless in his desire to find just the right detail, the little thing that's going to tell you everything about a man. After The Deer Hunter, he and I made Falling in Love, and I had the privilege of watching his process. In a wardrobe test, for 3 hours, he tried on 37 identical little boxy jackets, windbreakers. To me, they looked identical, but he's checking the cuff, the collar, the zip, up, no, down, down, yeah, no, yeah, down. Until he found the right one, and the right one was the right one because it signified. It told you everything about this guy's socioeconomic status. It showed you his modesty and his precision. It was just tan. It was ignorable, but that's different from unimportant. Details are important, and Bob knows that. He changed everything for generations of actors. He took Brando's lesson in authenticity, which is claiming the moment for what an actor really feels, and then he just pushed it a little further in imaginative scope, shape-shifting his outside without ever compromising the soul of his character. In the brilliant and mundane and telling choices and details that accumulate to make a life's work, we take the measure, the full measure of Robert De Niro, this formidable actor, this fine, fine man.
And this is where we usually do a little biographical tracking of the man's life, but, well, Meryl Streep did it next, so why should we bother? Let's take a listen.
Greenwich Village, the 40s. Bob grew up the child of two of its most passionate painters. He was always watching, his mother said. His art was always going to be acting. The streets were his palette. Everything he saw, he brought with him to his craft. Even in shoestring productions, he burned a hole in the screen. But his future wasn't going to be in Hollywood. It was just down the street with Marty Scorsese. They were two young, hungry guys hell-bent on putting the real on screen.
You make me laugh, you know that? You know, I borrow money all over this neighborhood, left and right, from everybody. I never paid them back, so I can't borrow no money from nobody no more, right? So who does that leave me to borrow money from but you? I borrow money from you because you're the only jerk around here that I can borrow money from without paying back, right?
You talking to me? You talking to me?
In Marty, he found a director he trusted. One pushed, and the other flew.
He has an extraordinary genius to be able to transform himself, to undergo a metamorphosis, and to simply be. Just be the person he's playing, not act, but become and command and inhabit the character. He throws himself into the deepest and darkest chasms and always comes out a human being.
You call me?
I will.
No matter how big I get, no matter who I fight, no matter what I do, I ain't never gonna find you loose.
Yeah, that's right. He's a heavyweight, you're a middleweight. We know that.
I ain't never gonna get a chance to fight the best there is. And you know something? I'm better than him. I ain't never gonna get a chance.
Every face is a landscape. Each performance touches center.
I want you to get this where he breathes. I want you to find this Nancy boy, Elliot Ness. I want him dead. I want his family dead. I want his house burnt to the ground.
There's your pillow.
Feel better?
Yeah, I do.
Good.
I'm a realist. I understand it's the 21st century, and you've probably had premarital relations with my daughter. But under our roof, it's my way or the Long Island Expressway. Is that understood?
Of course.
Yeah. Good. Keep your snake in its cage for 72 hours.
Okay.
Not far from where his parents painted, he built a studio for filmmakers. And then a festival, a gift to the city he loves. If movies reflect the struggle within ourselves and our search for understanding, then this can be called the Age of De Niro.
And following Meryl Streep's little history package, up step Joe Pesci.
I owe Mr. De Niro a lot, probably a lot more than most people. He was very, very generous, and I was really, I mean, it was on Goodfellas, which we'll be seeing shortly. I was stabbing Frank Vincent in the trunk, and very viciously, and enjoying it. And in between takes, I was breathing very heavily and couldn't wait to get back in and do it again. And Bob kept looking at me. I felt this presence staring at me. And I looked at him and I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Nothing, nothing." I said, "If you don't tell me what it is, I'm going to stab you with the knife." And he said, "I think you're going too fast with the knife." He said, "You could never get it in and out of the ribs that quickly."
And when we come back, we're going to hear more great artists talking about another great artist, Robert De Niro. This is Lee Habib. On this day in history, Robert De Niro was born in 1943. As always, our This Day in Histories are brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College, a great place to study all the things that matter in life. Go to hillsdale.edu and check out their terrific online courses, particularly the C.S. Lewis 10-part series. It should not be missed. Our American Stories, the life of Robert De Niro, born on this day in history in 1943. Two Oscars, of course, one for Vito Corleone as a young man, Godfather 2, that was 74, and as Jake LaMotta in The Raging Bull in 1980. But my goodness, over 100 movies, you name the kind of acting style, and particularly comedy, which he tackled later in life, first in Analyze This, and then, of course, in Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers. And the guy just nails it. So there was nothing Robert De Niro couldn't do. But let's get back to the actors, directors, and artists who talked about De Niro. Here is his pal, his partner. Neither of these guys would have been the people they were without each other. Here's Martin Scorsese.
To be certain, he has an extraordinary genius to be able to transform himself, to undergo a metamorphosis, and to simply be, just be the person he's playing, not act, but become and command and inhabit the character. So many of those characters who refuse to forgive themselves. I never knew where you pulled it from. I guess I still don't. Of course, it has to be from his intelligence and his bravery in the analysis of those characters, how he throws himself into the deepest and darkest chasms and always comes out a human being. That's the trick. At times, working with him, I felt, I thought that we had kind of a unique understanding of each other, and I'd hope that the audience would sense that and relate to that connection. That's what kept us pushing, I think, in those pictures. He never looks down on the characters he plays. He never judges them. And this is the way he is out of character, too. As a man and a friend, he is compassionate and trustworthy. He's a good man.
And you heard that again and again. Again and again. Here's Billy Crystal talking about working with Robert De Niro.
So we're in Paris. We were doing a press junket for Analyze This in France, and we were very tired. We had done 70 interviews in the one afternoon, and I was exhausted because he insists that we do everything together for the simple reason that I talk. We do 6 minutes at a clip. For 5 minutes and 55 seconds, I go on and on and on. The interviewer usually says, "And you, Mr. De Niro, what do you think?" And he'll go, "Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like you said, yeah. We done?" That's the Robert De Niro that I know and I love.
And Crystal goes on to say even more nice things about this partner.
He is such an icon to people that when I started working with him years ago, people said to me, "What do you call him? You know, what do you call him? You know, what's he like? What do you call him?" And so here was a little rule of thumb for those of you who are asking the same question, who don't know him like I'm fortunate to do. First of all, of course, there's Robert De Niro. That's very respectful, safe, smart. It's his billing. It's a great name. Then there's Bob De Niro. Now, this is for people who know him, friends that he trusts. He likes having you around. When you're a solid friend with him, you get to call him Bob. Then there's Bobby. Now, Bobby is reserved for movie executives who have never met him. Well, regardless of what you call him, we're all gathered here tonight for one reason: fear. What would happen to us if we didn't show up? He has made over 60 films, 20 of them last year. And over half of them have taken place in New York City. So tonight, my friend, is not only about you, but also about the love you have for that great city where you have lived your entire life.
And it's so true. It's a character in so much of the art that he and Scorsese put together. And think about his best work and where Raging Bull is set, where Mean Streets is set, where Goodfellas is set. And they knew those streets. And by the way, they grew up down in Soho and Greenwich Village when it was not what it is today. And very poor sections of New York City are no longer poor, and now even Brooklyn. And they nail New York like nobody else. So let's get into some of the acting. And one of our favorites here is A Bronx Tale, where De Niro doesn't play the bad guy. He plays the good guy. He plays a bus driver. And the bus driver has a son who's attracted to this wise guy on a street corner. And the wise guy is slowly pulling the son into his orbit. De Niro is trying to keep his son from the streets and trying to teach him what a working life looks like and what being a man looks like. And there's this incredible scene where the son comes home and he's got a big stash of cash. And Robert De Niro finds it. And he's going to go straight down to that bar where Sonny, played by Chaz Palminteri, is about to get a confrontation with a guy without a gun but with a whole lot of anger. Let's take a listen.
We can't accept that.
I didn't give it to you. I gave it to your son. He worked for me.
That's right, my son. And I don't want my son involved in what goes on here.
Involved in what? What are you talking about?
Please, I'm not a stupid man, okay? Please, I'm not stupid. You know what I'm talking about. Just stay away from my son, okay?
Hey, you stay right over here. See, why don't you go outside? I want to talk to your father.
I'll speak to my own son. Claudio, wait outside.
First of all, I respect you, Lorenzo. You're a stand-up guy. We're from the same neighborhood. But don't ever talk to me like that again. I tell your son to go to school, to go to college.
You don't understand. It's not what you say. It's what he sees. It's the clothes, it's the cars, it's the money, it's everything. He tried to throw away his baseball cards the other day because he said Mickey Mantle would never pay my rent.
He said that to you? Who's kidding?
That's not funny. Not funny when your 9-year-old kid has a bigger bank account than you do.
I offered you a job, but you said no to me.
That's right, and I say no now. Just leave my son alone, please.
Hey! Don't you see how I treat that kid? I treat that kid like he's my son.
He ain't your son. He's my son.
He's what?
He's my son.
Come on, get out of here.
I'm not afraid of you.
Well, you should be.
I know who you are, Sonny. I know what you're capable of, and I would never step out of line. You could ask anybody in this neighborhood who knows me. But this time you're wrong. You don't fool with a man's family. This is my son, not yours.
What are you going to do, fight
you
me?
You stay away from my
get
son.
Get out of here before I give you a
get
slap.
You just stay away from my son.
Go ahead.
I don't care who you are. You stay away from my son.
Get out of here.
Where's my money, Dad?
I left it in there.
What? How could you do that, Daddy? It was my money.
That's bad money. I don't want you to have that money.
Dad, I earned that money.
I said I want you to stay away from him.
Dad, please listen to me.
I said you stay away from him.
Dad, listen to me.
Did you hear what I said? You stay away from him.
Sonny was right. The Walker man is a sucker, Dad. He's a sucker.
He's wrong. It don't take much strength to pull a trigger, but try and get up every morning, day after day, and work for a living. Let's see him try that. Then we'll see who's the real tough guy. The working man is the tough guy. Your father's the tough guy.
Everybody loves him, just like everybody loves you on the bus. It's the same thing.
No, it's not the same. People don't love him. They fear him. There's a difference.
I understand that.
You will when you get older. I'm sorry I hit you.
It's a remarkable piece of work. It's called The Bronx Tale. Rent it. See it. And let me tell you a backstory on that movie. Charles Palminteri was an unknown. He was doing a one-man play in Los Angeles, and he played all the characters. You rent it, you'll see what a rich world he had created. And De Niro got wind of it and calls Charles Palminteri and says, I love this. Let's make this into a movie. And Charles Palminteri says, I ain't selling it. I got to star it. And he goes, well, of course you're gonna. Above the title. There was no negotiation. De Niro wanted to make Palminteri a star, and he did not want to change the play. He just wanted to make it come true. And he made Chaz Palminteri's dreams come true. And it is a perfect movie by a remarkable actor. And think about just in the 70s. Mean Streets, The Godfather Part II, Taxi Driver, Deer Hunter, and Raging Bull. That's just the start. And then you go into the 80s and it's True Confessions, King of Comedy, The Mission, The Untouchables, Midnight Run, Goodfellas, Awakenings, Cape Fear. And it just goes on and on. And Heat, my favorite. The Al Pacino and Robert De Niro scene everybody's been waiting for all those years. This is Lee Habib, Robert De Niro. In other actors' words, we celebrate his life. He was born on this day in history in 1943. As always, our This Day in History is brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College. How precious did
disappear. The hour I first believed.
And you're listening to Alan Jackson's rendition of Amazing Grace. And it's time for our final thought segment. And that's when we bring you a eulogy or a remembrance of a loved one. We do this regularly. Sometimes famous, sometimes not. And tonight, it's a personal one. And you may have heard the news. It was a plane crash in Alabama, and three couples were killed. They were flying from Kissimmee, back from a dental conference. And 11 children in Oxford, Mississippi, were rebroadcast. Don't have a mother and father. The crash happened at about 11:20 a.m., just east of Tuscaloosa Regional Airport in Northport. The crash site was in a wooded field, very close to a runway that these three couples just didn't reach. There had been problems with the engine. They were supposed to get to Oxford, signaled to try and make Tuscaloosa, and they didn't. Michael and Kim Perry, Jason and Leah Faris, Austin and Angie Poole left 11 children. And tonight I'm going to talk a bit about Michael Perry because he was a remarkable man and a courageous man, and courage these days is in short supply. You know, Aristotle once said that courage is the first of human qualities because it is a quality which guarantees all of the others. And I met Michael because he had given me a call, because he had wanted to take on some powerful folks in the city of Oxford and at the university in particular. And the university just happens to be a very big employer in this town. And so to take on the university is to take on a lot. And anybody who lives in a small university town knows this. And those officials yield tremendous power. And it had to do with an athletic director. And ultimately, I got involved. And I said, Michael, if we do this, I don't make a living from this town. And I don't know a lot of people here. As you can tell from my accent, I'm a Yankee living in the heart of Dixie. And Michael is a good old boy from Brandon, came up from nothing and built a great dental practice. But he had a heart for people. And most of all, this man had a heart for the truth. He loved Christ. He loved the underdog. And he loved Ole Miss. And so he said, you bet. I'll take this on and I'll put my name on it. And there were a whole bunch of other people in this town that didn't put their name on it because they were afraid. They were afraid of reprisals from their own university officials, people they paid taxes to. And Michael, no. His partner, Hayden Perkins, no, stepped right into the breach and put their names on it, put their efforts behind it. And Michael once told me, I grew up with nothing, and me and my wife would be perfectly happy to have nothing again rather than submit to these guys. And I fell in love with Michael instantly. And for guys who know what it means to love another guy, you know what I'm talking about. And so for about 3 months, we went through a trial together with a band of small guys and took a lot of heat, and it was a lot of nasty insults hauled. And Michael stayed with it. And ultimately that person was replaced. Fantastic people were brought in, and it changed the town. It changed a sports program, and none of it could have happened without Michael Perry. And I want to read a little bit from the Oxford Eagle about Michael, because he was also the driving force behind the Oxford Lafayette Sportsplex, which he built for kids who just didn't have a lot. And Michael poured his money into this. He poured his heart into this. He faced resistance here too. What a guy. He married his sweetheart, who he'd known since he was 14. Went to college with her. And just a beautiful, beautiful couple. And what I want to do now is share with you the living testament to who Michael was as a man. This is a Facebook post his 13-year-old wrote. And if I can get through this, well, I don't know if I'm capable of it. But take a listen to this. Sarah Perry. Okay, she starts. So I wanted to start by thanking everyone for the hugs, kind paragraphs, and yes, I read every single text, Snapchat, DM, Facebook message, even if I didn't respond, and support. I also wanted to thank everyone for helping me celebrate Elise Farise's 14th birthday yesterday. This girl, her parents died on Sunday, and her birthday was Monday. I love you so much. Every single hug and message filled my broken heart. The truth is, yes, I am heartbroken, sad, tired, and devastated, but I have to keep my faith. It has to grow stronger and stronger. This wild journey brought me closer to my family and grew my relationship with God. And this, I think, is just the beginning. I also wanted to thank every single teacher, parent, and other supporters for everything. You all are the best and have kept my whole family strong. I'm not going to lie. Yeah, it hurts to never have someone called mom or dad again. And I don't know why tragic, horrible things like this happen. But what I do know is that I have aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandmothers who will be with me on this journey. I also know I will stay strong for my brother and sister. I will help them with anything they need. I will be my sister's Santa Claus. I will be there for her when she gets older. I will help my brother with his homework and with any problems he ever has. And I will also help my grandmother, who will be raising me for the rest of my life. It will be hard. And there will be obstacles along the way. But if we all stay strong and stick together, we can get through this. Because I know this is what my parents would want. My goodness, this girl's reassuring us. Again, 13 years old. I know for a fact I will never physically see my parents again on this earth. But they will never, ever leave my heart. They will still guide me through life. They will help me with my problems. I know I will see them in heaven. So this is not the end. Boy, that's Michael. Defiance in the face of adversity. I know they supported and cared for me so much. I know they loved me and would do anything for me. The main thing I ask y'all is to share any memories with me if you have any of my parents. If you don't hesitate, if you want to ask me questions, please, we can get through this together. Again, reassuring us, asking us to share. I promise we can get through this together. So I'm going to get out of here now and be my best. I will get through this. Thank y'all for everything. That's about as good a piece of writing as I've read. And we did Solzhenitsyn's speech at Harvard a couple of weeks ago. And I'll hold this right up to that. Because what was Solzhenitsyn writing about? Not communism and what it did to him in that gulag in Soviet Union, but what materialism could do in this country to our immortal souls. And that materialism itself could be as crushing to the human spirit as socialism or communism. And Michael Perry was proof that there's a God. And my goodness, this little girl, this young lady, she's teaching us all how to be strong. And so this goes out to you, Michael. Thanks for teaching me how to be a man, to be a leader, and to have courage myself. And to all the families that mourn in this great small town called Oxford. And by the way, the town came together. 2,500 people showed up on Monday for a prayer session with Baptists, Methodists, and Catholics, singing Amazing Grace, hugging, forming prayer groups, meals provided, the heart of the American South. On display for anyone to see. Simple life, yes. Small town, yes. But my goodness, thank goodness a tragedy happened in a place like this, where all that love could be gathered around, and God's love too. This is Lee Habib, Final Thoughts. And this is Our American Stories.
And we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun. We've no less days to sing.
This is Our American Stories, and we love to do segments about this thing called the American Dream. We know it's alive and kicking, because I think if you opened up the doors, 50 to 100 million people would probably come here. So we know it's alive. Some people in America might not think it is, but the rest of the world does. And we love to tell stories about American Dream, and some of our best. An Hour with Mario Andretti, what a life story. And today, we're going to listen to the story of one such American dreamer who, in the world of business, changed the world, revolutionized the world. A very unlikely person to do so from his past and from his very humble beginnings. Let's take a listen to this story.
Here I go. Higher, higher. Here I go.
He created the world on time, a modern wonder where everything from the latest gadgets to the most critical documents, what you want and what you really need, can be delivered overnight. His team works this fast.
Okay, you just travel plans. I need to be in New York on Monday, LA on Tuesday, New York on Wednesday, LA on Thursday, New York on Friday. Got it?
Got it.
So you want to work here? What really makes you think you deserve a job here?
Well, sir, I think on my feet I'm good to figures and I have a sharp mind.
Excellent. Can you start on Monday?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Without hesitation.
Congratulations. Welcome aboard. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And in conclusion, Jim, Bill, Bob, call Fred, Lowe, Dork, Abe, and Ted. Business is business. And as we all know, in order to get something done, you got to do something. In order to do something, we've got to get to work. So let's get to work. Thank you for taking the meeting. Petey did a bang-up job. I'm putting you in charge of Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
I know it's perfect, Petey. That's why I picked Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's perfect. Petey, may I call you Pete?
Call me Pete.
Pete.
Is Mr. Schnittler here to see you?
I'm to wait 15 seconds.
Can you wait 15 seconds?
I'll wait 15 seconds.
Congratulations on your deal in Denver, Dave. I'm putting you down to deal with Dallas. Don, is it a deal? Do we have a deal? It's a deal. I got to go. I got a call coming in. Hi, Doc. Just dealt with Donnie.
In this fast-moving, high-pressure, get-it-done-yesterday world, aren't you glad there's one company that can keep up with it all?
You got a deal. Good. I'm putting you down to deal with Dick. Dick, what's the deal with the deal? Are we dealing? We're dealing. Dave, it's a deal with Don, Doc, Dick. Doc, it's a deal with Dave, Dick, and Dave. Don, it's a Doc with Dick, Dave, and Dick. Gotta go, Dave. Disconnecting. Gotta go, Dick. Disconnecting. Gotta go, Dad. Disconnecting.
Federal Express. But it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight.
And all of this started with a college term paper. Its author was studying economics at Yale in 1965.
Anyone know what this is, class? Anyone? Anyone? Anyone seen this before? Anyone? Anyone?
Having a grand old time as a fraternity member.
I don't think you can fully judge a fraternity without looking at the positive qualities of the people in it.
Getting gentlemanly C's. But this paper, this one, stood out. In it, a young undergrad pondered what would have to change in society, in logistics, as our world became more and more automated, more computerized. After all, computers break down, and always keeping a spare for every part would be impractical. So we needed a customized transportation system, one that could move valuable things cross-country in the time it usually takes to move something cross-state. From that insight sprung one of the biggest companies in the world, today employing over 300,000 people. 300,000. A team that powers businesses of all sizes and the occasional giant panda adventure.
We needed to find a partner that could transport the giant pandas from China to Canada. We also needed a partner that could ship the bamboo, which will be coming from the Memphis region. There's not many partners out there that can do all of that. We're very pleased that FedEx stepped up.
FedEx did more than just step up. They emblazoned a giant panda onto an airplane and called it the Panda Express. When something absolutely, positively has to get there, you call FedEx. But this idea may never have gotten off the ground, but for a family of entrepreneurs, but for a little old war called Vietnam, and but for a visionary young man, Fred Smith. Fred Smith was born in 1944 in Marks, Mississippi, a tiny town of about 2,000 people, due east of the mighty Mississippi River. Fred's grandfather, Captain James Buchanan Smith, was a master of steamboats along that river and the Ohio River, moving people and cargo up and downstream. Fred's father, James Frederick Smith, who also went by Fred, realized that the rivers of water connecting people then would soon give way to rivers of asphalt and concrete. And so he began selling trucks in nearby Memphis for the John T. Fisher Motor Company, one of the very first Chrysler franchises. In 1925, Fred's father took a truck that his boss had given him, replaced its cargo area with seating for 12, and began ferrying men and material around. What began as a one-man motor coach company turned into a 25-car company by the second year. And by the end of the third year, he had 60 coaches. Fred's father sold the company to Greyhound in 1931, more than a dozen years before Fred was born. But before young Fred could dream up ways to continue the family tradition of transportation, he had some other challenges. He had a rare childhood bone disease causing arthritis of the hip, which forced him to use crutches and watch sports from the sidelines in his early years. Fred outgrew the disease by the age of 10 and became an excellent football player. He even learned how to fly airplanes as a 15-year-old. Overcoming so many obstacles without one of the most important figures in a boy's life.
And when we come back, more on the life of the founder of FedEx, Fred Smith. And you're going to learn about what a role his life in the Marine Corps played as it related to building this great company. This is our American Dreamer segment, as always, brought to us by the folks at Job Creators Network. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. It's our American Dreamer segment, and you're learning a bit about Fred Smith, his father, his background, where he grew up, the founder of FedEx. I mean, it's hard to imagine life without FedEx, but it started with that thesis at Yale, and let's pick up where we left off.
Fred outgrew the childhood bone disease causing arthritis of the hip by the age of 10, overcoming so many obstacles without one of the most important figures in a boy's life.
Having grown up without a father, my father passed away when I was four. So I was heavily influenced by my uncles and by my coaches. And they were the influences that really I can hear their voices to this day, you know, talking to me. And I still hear my uncles, all of them World War II veterans, and part of the greatest generation, and my coaches there telling me, well, you know, you need to do this, that, and the other thing.
Those same men inspired Fred to make a choice that would define his life and character.
I was coming out of high school. There wasn't much question about the fact I was going to do my military service. It was just a matter of which branch. And so the Marine Corps appealed to me. The uniforms looked great.
Fred left Memphis in 1962 for Yale. He would train with the Marines during the summer and go to class during the year. Life seemed to be going according to plan. It was during his junior year at Yale that Fred came up with the original idea for FedEx in that term paper. But before Fred could grow that into something that would change the world, events halfway around the world sent Fred to a very different sort of classroom. He soon left Yale, left with a degree, and left with a commission as an officer in the United States Marine Corps, shipping out for the first of his two tours in Vietnam.
I joined my unit in Chu Lai. I became a platoon leader and served in India Company and Lima Company. I was then given command of K Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines.
This was a very different war than World War II or Korea, with no clear battle lines. On a Monday morning in May 1968, Fred and his K Company engaged a much larger North Vietnamese battalion. Moving across fire-swept ground to reach higher elevation, Fred started calling down artillery and airstrikes to within 50 meters of where he himself stood. With fire support sowing confusion among the enemy, Fred and his Marines attacked and routed the much larger North Vietnamese force. What stands out most to Fred isn't the action, it's his fellow Marine. To this day, Fred beams with pride when he remembers the men he served with in K Company.
There is nothing in my life that I'm more proud of than commanding K Company 3-5. They were the finest group of young men in those days that you could ever hope to have, courageous beyond belief.
Fred Smith returned to the States and was honorably discharged as a captain, having earned a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, and 2 Purple Hearts. But he had had enough of war, later saying of that time, "I got so sick of destruction and blowing things up that I came back determined to do something more constructive." It was then that he thought of his college term paper about a transportation network for the new digital age. It was dusty, but more relevant than ever.
It was pretty clear then, with IBM, installing the big computers around, that the world was going to change. And the paper was about how this was going to change a lot of things, and in particular, it was going to change the way things had to be distributed and moved to support those automated devices.
Just as his grandfather and father used the cutting-edge technology of their day, Fred envisioned a seamless network of airplanes and trucks. Other companies in the 1960s were also trying to speed up movement of high-value items, but they stuck to systems designed for passengers. Fred realized that unlike passengers during that era, packages didn't have to go directly from origin to destination. Airplanes could speed packages to and from a national clearinghouse, and trucks could make the final delivery. This way, two small towns that don't have frequent flights, or any at all, could still be connected with the speed of airplanes. Fred had seen how such a system might work.
The Marine Corps' air-ground integration is a huge benefit. And one of the big innovations that Federal Express did, nobody had ever done before, was to have integrated air-ground operations. The pickup and delivery folks were just like the pilots and the airplanes and everything was coordinated just as we had done in the Marine Corps, and all of those lessons that I'd learned there on the ground and in the air in Vietnam played over and over in my mind as we were putting together the business plan for FedEx.
His father started his motor coach company with a truck. Fred started with a handful of airplanes. He had the idea that he would make deliveries for the Federal Reserve System by transporting, sorting, and rerouting checks, all with guaranteed delivery in 24 hours. Fred's calculations showed that he could save the American banking industry $3 million a day. He even named his company Federal Express, hoping that it would resonate with the banks and conjure up images of nationwide commerce. Today you know this company as FedEx, serving customers like this.
If a patient gets in a car accident and breaks their skull, we manufacture and produce the plates and screws that will actually screw into the bone and mend the fracture. So with these types of procedures, time is extremely valuable to the patient, to the surgeon, and everyone involved. So
with our previous shipping carrier, it took us 3 days to ship the products from Freiburg, Germany, the manufacturing facility, here to the United States. That was in many times not fast enough. Exceptional service that FedEx provided for an urgent case that was planned first thing on a Monday morning. The implant was shipped from Germany on Saturday morning by FedEx. It was imported into the United States and it was received by the Stryker representative at the airport on Sunday evening. Now, this is a one-day transit time on the weekend from Europe to the United States.
But back when the company was starting, not one bank believed it could deliver. So Fred, like any Marine, adapted and overcame by making a slight course correction. He would deliver any company's time-sensitive material anywhere in the country with his 24-hour guarantee.
It's not like we're carrying sand and gravel. You know, we're carrying chemotherapy drugs and important manuscripts and electronic parts and pieces for airplanes that are grounded. So when we pick it up and say we're going to have it there early the next morning, I mean, we have to deliver. There's nothing else to it. So this is guaranteed. If we don't get it there, I mean, we don't get paid.
FedEx officially began operations in April of 1973. On their first night, they delivered 186 packages to 25 cities with 14 airplanes and 389 team members. Most outsiders expected this innovation to fail. As Fred would later say of that time, "People thought we were bananas. We were too ignorant to know that we weren't supposed to be able to do certain things." Fred, though, believed.
They were bananas. 14 planes packed with 185 packages. You know what that cost per package delivery was? How did he bring that price down? How did he make this thing go? How did he make this turkey fly? Well, let me tell you, it never was a turkey. Only the turkeys thought this was a turkey. When we come back, Fred Smith's remarkable story, the creation of FedEx, and let me tell you, you'll hear him say it over and over again. The U.S. Marine Corps taught him more about life than anything else in life. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. We'll be right back. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Fred Smith's life, the founder of FedEx. And he talked about the fact that he lost his father, but it was those uncles and coaches. And so, man, if you're listening, you can always be a surrogate father to a boy who needs help. As he said, I can still hear their voices in my head. And without those men, there is no Fred Smith, I promise you. And he'll tell you that, too. And by the way, John Woods did terrific work on this piece that we're about to hear the end of. Let's dive back into the life of Fred Smith and FedEx.
In his time in Vietnam, he developed a willingness to take great risks to accomplish great things. Most businessmen couldn't imagine calling down bombs and napalm to within a few yards of themselves and their buddies. But sometimes, that's just what the mission requires. Fred's different experiences, different mindset, gave him a different take on his new business struggles.
The currency of exchange in FedEx was just money. You know, it wasn't people's arms and legs or lives. And so my perspective on it was perhaps a bit more, I was willing to take a chance, because losing wasn't the worst thing in the world that could happen to you. I had seen that very clearly.
But Fred's confidence and the brilliance of the model, in hindsight, weren't enough to create immediate success. 3 months after FedEx's launch, delivery drivers were frequently digging into their own pockets for gas money. And back in Memphis, things were just as grim. Federal Express had already lost one-third of its startup money. Roger Frock, a FedEx co-founder, recalled the desperate measures that had to be taken. By mid-July, our funds were so meager that on Friday, we were down to about $5,000 in the checking account, while we needed $24,000 for the jet fuel payment. When I arrived back in Memphis on Monday morning, much to my surprise, the bank balance stood at nearly $32,000. I asked Fred where the funds had come from, and he responded, "I knew we needed money for Monday, so I took a plane to Las Vegas and won $27,000. I said, "You mean you took our last $5,000? How could you do that?" He shrugged his shoulders and said, "What difference does it make? Without the funds for the fuel companies, we couldn't have flown anyway." As it turns out, time overseas had taught Fred more than the difference between reckless and calculated risk. It also gave him a chance to practice card games.
2 years in Vietnam, we played a lot of poker and a lot of blackjack, and in those days you only had one deck. So if you knew how to play, it was easier to win.
But the winnings didn't last long, and by October, only 3 months later, Federal Express was on death's doorstep again. Nearly killed in the cradle by the Arab oil embargo, gas prices skyrocketed. Federal Express was teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. And if it fell, it would take with it not only the $40 million of venture capital, but Fred's and his family's life savings as well. By April of 1975, 2 years after its opening night, Federal Express had lost nearly $29 million. Though it was losing money, the company's customer base was growing, and the underlying idea was as sound as ever. But Fred will be the first to admit that there's no such thing as a new idea.
If you brought Julius Caesar back to Earth, he would understand the organization of FedEx, because he basically invented it. We have our proconsul in Hong Kong. He had his in Palestine. We have our technical folks, our IT people, our aviation maintenance folks. He had his charioteers, his catapult operators, his engineers.
And in July 1975, the company began showing a profit. And just 9 years later, in 1984, Federal Express surpassed $1 billion in revenue, the first company to ever do so in its own right. Since then, FedEx has grown so much that it is woven into pop culture without the company even trying. Like in the Tom Hanks movie, Castaway.
I was marooned on an island for 5 years with this package, and I swore that I would deliver it to you because I work for FedEx. Hey, but by the way, what's in the package?
Nothing really. Just a satellite phone, GPS locator, fishing rod, water purifier, and some seeds. Just silly stuff. Thank you again. You keep up the good work.
When asked what was the key to his success, Fred is well known to give the credit to his employees. After all, they are on the front lines of the business. And of course, he learned the importance of that, once again, in the Marines.
It was the recognition that in a high-performance service organization, it's not the people at the top that are the most important folks in the equation, it's the customer service people.
There are many units under the FedEx umbrella, and each has a branding color scheme. Purple and orange for Original Express, purple and green for ground, purple and crimson for freight, and so on. All united by purple. Every FedEx employee knows what Fred Smith calls the Purple Promise. The simple pledge that I will make every FedEx experience outstanding. Employees like Trung Do.
The day I was rescued and sent to a refugee camp, that's the day I consider myself reborn. But the day I got a job with FedEx, that's the day I consider I have a new life, the best life I ever dreamed of.
Trung served alongside Americans during the Vietnam War and was sent to a hard labor camp by vengeful communists after America left. He eventually escaped and made his way to the States, where he dedicated his life to working on the same planes at the same company as the man who had sponsored him to come to America. Trung enrolled in Aviation Mechanics School in Memphis, a stone's throw away from FedEx DC-10 airplanes coming and going.
And the whole time I was in school, sitting in the back of the school, looking across runway 27 with FedEx over there, I was dreaming. I was praying to God, I want to be there someday.
He soon passed the mechanic test, applied to work at FedEx, and waited by the phone.
When FedEx called me and said that FedEx is going to give me a job as a senior mechanic with this kind of pay, blah, 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 blah. He said, oh, I was blind. I was deaf. My ears ringing. I couldn't hear a thing. All I hear is FedEx hiring me.
3 decades later, Trung Do is still working for FedEx in Fort Myers, Florida, keeping their 550-mile-per-hour delivery trucks in top condition. Still working for you. FedEx is still working for you for when your package absolutely, positively, has to be there overnight. And when it does, think of Fred Smith, who made it all possible. And thank your delivery driver, the way Fred would want.
And great job on that, John Woods. As always, these American Dreamer segments brought to us by the folks at Job Creators Network. I want to leave you with this simple thought. Fred Smith said, there are two simple rules to being a good combat leader. To be the first to charge up the hill and be the last in line to eat. He has clearly kept those things in mind long after leaving the Marines. He said this, although I'm chairman of the corporation, I can't get myself to cut into the line in the company cafeteria. Somewhere, a voice reminds me that a good officer lets his troops eat first. This is Our American Stories, American Dreamers. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. Catch all of ours. You'll love the Mario Andretti story.
Hanging out on the coast, oh well, those plans are long gone. And he said, there goes my There goes my life.
And you're listening to Kenny Chesney singing There Goes My Life. It changed his life, for sure. Catapulted his career. This song raced to the top of the charts. And on this show, we love music. I think it was Aquinas who said, when we sing, we pray twice. And there's nothing like it. Shut up, just listen. And we're going to do the story behind the story of this song, and we've done it for a few others. Gimme Shelter, what a story that is. Another Brick in the Wall. And we did it for Light My Fire. And this song, There Goes My Life, has quite a story behind it. Songwriter Neil Thrasher thought he knew everything about his best friend, fellow writer Wendell Mobley. And this is from Country Weekly. But as he pitched a song idea to Wendell, Neil would tap into a tender secret corner of his friend's life where an anguished memory had been bottled up for 19 years. We were writing together, Neil begins, and I came out on the front porch and said, why don't we write about a teenage boy who got his girlfriend pregnant, but they hung in there. I'd even had the words, There Goes My Life, in my notebook for over a year. At that point, Wendell softly spoke up. He tearfully told Neil about a daughter that he fathered while he was still in high school. My daughter's name was Lexi, Wendell explained to me. We lost her when she was a year old. Her birthday is March 17th. So these good friends didn't know this until this moment. Though he had been Neil's friends for years, Wendell had never shared this part of his life. Quote, I'd been getting kind of funky around her birthday, wondering what she'd be like now. Wendell confesses with a crack in his voice. Neil brought this song idea up at the right time. The revelation rocked Neil to the core. I had no idea about Wendell's past when we started writing that first verse on the porch, says Neil, who's the father of two young daughters himself. I've got to tell you, being friends with Wendell as long as I had been and finding out something like that, man. Neil's voice trails off after that, overcome by the emotional impact. He pauses for a moment to collect his thoughts. That just got all over me. I broke down in front of my wife. As the two began to dive into the song, the emotions poured out like water. We cried and wrote and sang and ate and cried and wrote and sang and ate, says Neil with a tension-releasing laugh. There wasn't any stopping. It was almost like therapy, writing it with someone so close to me. Kenny Chesney recorded that powerful tune about an initially reluctant father watching his daughter grow up from infancy to adulthood, with a decided change of emotions along the way. The single took off with rocket speed, hitting number one after just a few weeks. But beyond its chart success, There Goes My Life has wielded a far-reaching impact. Neil and Wendell have heard countless stories of estranged fathers and daughters actually reuniting, all because of their song. And of course, it changed for so many people. The whole idea of carrying a child to birth that otherwise they may not have wanted to. Right after we were done writing that song, Wendell remembers, Neil and I talked about how this was a perfect marriage between personal and universal storytelling. It's these kinds of stories when you know it's happening all over that is really so rewarding to hear. So I wanted to take you to an ASCAP Songwriters Conference in Boston. And I love these ASCAP Songwriters Conferences, and you hear us play them. Wendell was there, and so was Kenny Chesney. And here's Kenny giving props and respect to the writer and the man whose story turned into this song. Let's take a listen to Kenny Chesney.
I will tell you that when I remember the first time I heard this song, and my producer buddy Cannon, we were not in his Cadillac, Craig, but we were in his truck. And he goes, you got to hear something. And he played me this song. And the first words out of my mouth were, are you sure that we can record this song? Because I knew it was one of those songs that you just don't come across every day, you know, and it was...
As a songwriter, this is the best bridge to any song I've ever heard. This bridge kills me.
That kills me.
I'll cry when he sings it. Freaks me out every time.
So this song right here, I just want you guys to know... I think it might have been the first single off of the When the Sun Goes Down record,
I think. Yeah.
So, but I remember sitting in Buddy Cannon's truck hearing this song And it was just, I couldn't believe that I was the guy that got to go out and sing this song every night for the rest of my life. And that's how much I love this song.
Help me out, Kenny.
And like Sinatra, who always thanked his writers, Kenny Chesney always, and all these country artists, always give props to the writers. Because without the song, well, what do you have? And so at these great ASCAP conferences, the songwriter always gets to sing the first verse and chorus. And by the way, for my money, I like Wendell's version better. But you be the judge. Let's take a listen to Wendell Mobley.
I'm too young for this. Got my whole life ahead. Hell, I'm just a kid myself. How am I gonna raise one?
Now see, that's already a great song. Already.
All he could see were his dreams going up in smoke. So much for ditching this town, hanging out on the coast. Oh, well, those plans are long gone. And he said, there goes my life.
And that spontaneous applause from the audience showing their appreciation to the writer, and the writer, in the end, sharing his life with complete strangers. Let's take a listen to Kenny Chesney, who takes the second verse, hits that great bridge, and then takes it right out to the close.
A couple years I'm up on down, and a few thousand diapers later, that mistake you thought he made, covers up the refrigerator, oh yeah. And he loves that little girl. Mama waiting to tuck her in as she fumbled up those steps. She smiled back at him, dragging that teddy bear sleeve. Blue eyes and bouncing curls, and he smiled. There goes my life. There goes my future, my everything. I love you, Daddy. Good night. There goes my. With Abercrombie clothes, 15 pairs of shoes, in his American Express, he checked the old slam the hood, said you're good to go. She hugged them both and headed off to the West Coast. Baby, goodbye. There goes my life. Baby, goodbye.
Thank you. I love you, my man.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, buddy.
That first chorus, "There Goes My Life," resignation. Second chorus, "There Goes My Life," little girl running up the stairs. Third chorus, "There Goes My Life," she's out of here. The house is empty. Absolutely beautiful.
There goes my
The story of the story behind the story of "There Goes My Life." This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And great job to the whole crew here as always.
There goes my life. Baby, goodbye. Baby, goodbye. There goes my life.